one of the world's great walks. 190 miles or so from the Irish Sea to the North Sea, all the way across England. Far from the overburdened buses and tumultuous tube stations in London, a new England emerges. It's one made famous by travel writer Alfred Wainwright in the 1970s, etched into history on hand-drawn pages. Today's guest found those pages at his parents' house as a boy, and 50 years after they were first published, he set off across England on a coast-to-coast trek to follow the author's soggy footsteps. Welcome back to the Get Lost Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sills, a freelance writer for outlets around the globe. Today's guest is also a freelance writer, my brother in arms. He's contributed to 30 travel books across Europe, Asia, and the Americas, writing for outlets like the BBC, Nat Geo, and Lonely Planet. He's just come off of a coast-to-coast hike across England. His name is Daniel Stables. Dan, thanks for hopping on the show.
Thanks, man. Pleasure to be here.
First things first, is it Dan or Daniel? Does it matter?
People who know me call me Dan normally, but Daniel's like, you know, my byline. So Dan's fine.
Byline, Daniel Stables, at Muckrack. Look him up. So, dude, I want to thank you for coming on the show. We've been trying to connect and going in circles for months. And when I saw your latest piece pop up in The Telegraph, I said, damn, this is a story that we've got to tell. So the story is called I Didn't See Another Soul, Britain's Most Magical Walking Route. Talk to me about walking in Britain versus hiking in the U.S. Before we get into this coast-to-coast trail that you've done and this amazing story, a lot of our listeners in the U.K., a lot of them in the U.S., what is the difference between hiking and walking?
Well, I'll say there's a big difference in terms of the tradition of sort of hiking or walking as a leisure activity, like between the two countries. So Obviously you're talking about like different beasts, like landscape wise with the US and the UK, like US much more dramatic, much more extreme, obviously much bigger. In general, the UK is kind of, it's more accessible for more people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe part of the reason why there's a bit more of a tradition as well of what's called like open access or the right to roam, which is, I mean, it's not complete by any means, but there's been a big kind of history of people campaigning to have the right to walk across the countryside in the UK, and so to a certain extent that is enshrined in law. I met quite a few Americans actually when I was doing this the coast to coast. And I think the biggest difference really is that, so I mean, we don't differentiate so much with the terminology of walking and hiking. I suppose you'd say like hiking is more, you know, proper like backpacking.
Feels like it in my mind. It feels like hiking to me conjures images of like the Rocky Mountains or the Sierra Nevada and all this technical gear that you're wearing. And when I think about walking, I think about the guy that inspired your story, who's like this old British guy wearing a tweed suit walking around the countryside.
Yeah.
But it actually, in my experience, doesn't mean that going on a walk across England is easy at all. There are hills, there are dense forests, there's all kinds of stuff going on there, really craggy cliffs in some places. And I think you could even go a bit further and say that like Wales and Scotland is a whole nother beast that's really, really hiking to anyone in my mind.
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I mean, yeah, certainly. So I mean, the coast, as you mentioned, like Scotland, parts of Wales maybe as well, particularly in the Highlands of Scotland is like, you know, that's proper mountain country, and it's proper wilderness up there, which is in the UK, wilderness is quite hard to find. I think that's another difference really with the US. We don't have massive tracts of wilderness anymore. And even if we did, it wouldn't take you that long to walk and just get out of them.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, this is like the big difference is, you know, in the US, you have these amazing hiking trails, hundreds of even thousands of miles, where you basically have to, you know, there aren't like hotels or B&Bs, as we call them here, where you can just stay for the night and it's like a nice cozy place. Like there might be shelters, right? But you can, you're kind of camping, or you're like roughing it to a certain extent. In the UK, I think because of the smaller distances, you're always pretty much ending the day in like in a village or a town or something. And then you can often stay in like a nice, like above a pub or something like that. So I think, yeah, I mean, the Americans who I met in the coast to coast were like, I think part of the reason they come to the UK to do a walk like that is, you know, they love walking, they love being in the outdoors, but they didn't necessarily want to through hike, you know, the Pacific Crest Trail or something like that.
Actually, yeah, that makes sense to me. So yeah. A couple of years ago, when my dad passed away, I felt like I needed to get away into the wilderness, but I didn't want to deal with the PCT or the John Muir Trail or the Appalachian Trail because they're really rugged. Like you have to gear up, you have to be mentally 100% there, or you know you're gonna screw up and get lost or die, mm-hmm. or get bitten by a snake or something or a bear. Yeah. So what I did was I went to your country. I flew over to the UK about 6 months after his funeral, and I got a ride up to Newcastle, and I started hiking with Raven De Silva, who's a guest on the show. I started hiking across the coast at Hadrian's Wall Path, which is a different route than you went. But what I found out there was serenity, because it's rolling hills, meadows, this ancient wall. And there was a path that I just followed. I didn't have to have a map even. I did, but I didn't need a map, right? You just follow the signs and you can tune out. And for, I want to say about a week, maybe more, however long it took us to get across there. It's maybe 90 miles or something from coast to coast at that point. Mm-hmm. I could just zone out, and I found a real healing in the UK. I was in England. You know, people think it's in Scotland. It's not. It's in England. And it was some of the most beautiful landscape and nature that I've ever seen. And I don't know that Americans specifically appreciate that, because we think England and we think London, but I find the UK to have some of the most stunning natural areas of anywhere in the world. What do you think? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I'm going through this journey, which I think a lot of us have. I think it happens naturally as you get older anyway, but being, particularly with the pandemic and everything, being forced to kind of discover your own backyard a bit more. So I really am coming to appreciate the UK a lot more. Like for me, like it always used to be for me that it was like, it didn't feel like a proper adventure unless you were like flying for 10 hours, you know?
Oh yeah.
Somewhere you've never been before. So I think, you know, and obviously working as a travel writer is like, it's a great privilege because you get the chance to, do that stuff on sort of company time, as it were, like, and you get paid to do it, and you get to do a lot more of it. Sure. But yeah, I think like with, you know, the flip side of what I was saying about it, small distances, it's not quite as like dramatic and epic in scale as someone like the US. But on the other hand, it's, you get in like Northern England, for example, where Hadrian's Wall is, which you walked, and also the coast to coast, they're pretty close to each other. Mm. There's such a diversity of landscapes in quite a small span of space. So like
absolutely,
the coast to coast is 2.5 weeks, and you go through the Lake District, which is like, you know, world famous sort of beauty spot. And then you're in the Yorkshire Dales, and then the North York Moors. So the lakes obviously are like mountains and lakes. The Dales are sort of rolling countryside, classic sort of English hills and countries of farmland. And then you're in the North York Moors, which is like barren, sort of like, you know, Wuthering Heights sort of country. So yeah, and you can do it all in a couple of weeks really. And that's the upside, I'd say, of kind of a smaller scale country. Because, and even being able to walk coast to coast in that time is like, that's pretty cool when you think about it, because, you know, most countries that have an east and a west coast, you're not going to be able to walk from one to the other in a couple of weeks.
It sounds impressive. It sounds cool. When I came back, I was like, yeah, I was just like coast to coast in England. And they're like,
yeah,
wow. I'm like, yeah, that's right. Not north to south, though.
Yeah. John O'Groats to Land's End is a different kettle of fish. But still, I mean, probably wouldn't take that long.
Probably not. Maybe we should do that one day.
Maybe we should do that, yeah.
So let's get into the heart of the show. I want to talk about this story. I didn't see another soul. And I want you to take me through the inspiration. Like, how did this story become an idea for you? And then walk us through the journey of it, the experience that you went through, what you saw, what you felt, the funny things that happened.
Sure. So, I mean, I had actually been thinking for a while of doing the walk that you did, Hadrian's Wall Path. Mm. Hadrian's Wall Path is one of, I think it's about maybe 16 official national trails in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And I've walked a couple of them before. And it's always a great experience. They're like, they're sort of well signposted and stuff. And it's kind of, it. When I was first getting into like long distance hiking and walking, it was a kind of, it felt like a kind of accessible way of getting into it.
It is totally sort of
getting
into
the outdoors.
They're like, and, well manicured paths. Go on.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. But I was thinking, I wanted to do Hadrian's Wall. I always love, like, I'm interested in, you know, history, Roman history. And Hadrian's Wall is, as you'll know if you read Joe's piece on it, it's like it was the frontier of the Roman Empire at one time.
Hmm.
Hence built by Emperor Hadrian. And so you have like still remains of like forts right along the wall.
Yeah, super cool.
Really cool, yeah. And I've been to like some of them before, but I've never sort of walked it in its entirety. And I don't know if you did this, but I want to kind of extend it a little bit on each side so that mm-hmm. I would be like boots in the sea on the west coast and the east coast.
That's exactly what we did, yeah.
Yeah.
Because like, I guess it's the travel writer in you, but I just couldn't do, the trail doesn't actually go from the sea to the sea, but it goes really close. I was like, F it.
You might
like,
as well.
I'm just going to go a whole way. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was like an extra 20 miles. It was totally worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so I was thinking of doing that actually, but then, I came across, I mean, again, sort of like lifting the veil a bit on, how being a travel writer works, but like a lot of it's to do with timing, right? Mm-hmm. When you do a certain story. And I realized that, the coast to coast was, it was 50 years since it had been created this year. Mm. And so that seemed like a good time, to do a story about it because I'll give some background on how it was created. Yeah. You mentioned, the guy earlier who, created the trail, his name's Alfred Wainwright. And he is a very sort of British type of figure. And he was a hill walker, so he used to love going walking in the Lake District in the hills. And he became famous in the UK in the 1970s for a series of guidebooks that he wrote to the Lake District. So he was a fellow travel writer, kind of. Well, he was.
Like a hill walking version.
Yeah, it was like a very, very niche. But but his books are amazing. They're like, he hand wrote all of them. And that's how they were published with his handwriting. And he drew maps and he was an amazing drawer. He drew like, you know, pictures of the hills and the waterfalls and stuff that you saw. And so they're real little works of art, his books.
Yeah.
And I've always been a fan of those. And another book that he wrote, most of his books were just about the Lake District, but he wrote a book called A Coast to Coast Walk, which came out in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
So hence 50 years ago. It was just his dream was to create this walk from St. Bees, which is a village in Cumbria, which is on the west coast of England. And it finishes in a place called Robin Hood's Bay, which is on the east coast in Yorkshire.
That makes sense to me. That sounds very British.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so he says in the right at the beginning of the book, you know, this is not something that you have to do exactly as I did it. It's like the spirit of the thing is that you go from one coast of England to the other. You don't have to do it in one go. It doesn't matter how long you take it takes you. I mean, in fact, one of his big kind of credos that he talked about was, he said, you should always take time to stand and stare.
Yeah.
And some of the people now who do the coast to coast do it in like, I mean, I think the record is 39 hours, 39 That's and a half hours. Wild. Like yeah. An ultra marathon.
How long is the distance?
It's like 180 odd miles.
Yeah. That's a pretty serious walk.
Yeah. So to do it in one go with no sleep or anything like that is, I think it's amazing, obviously, very impressive. But I think Wainwright would have probably been a bit sort of baffled by that.
Do you remember the first time you saw one of his books? Is there a moment in your head? Like, how old were you?
That's a good question. You know, I think I'm pretty sure my mum and dad had one or two of them around the house. So even when I first would have seen them, they would have been, you know, ancient looking. And then you open them up and they're like, it's like handwritten. I mean, obviously it's printed, but it's like printed from his handwriting. You don't really get many books like that, you know?
No, I've never seen anything like that other than like The Hobbit, you know, in the movie.
Exactly, yeah. And it's like, it's almost like that sort of vibe, like you're opening up and you're reading about a sort of adventure, particularly with the Coast to Coast one, because the other ones are sort of guidebooks more. Mm-hmm. And they include detail about like the different hills and the mountains and stuff. But so his, you know, he devised this walk and he said it would take you sort of 2 weeks more or less. But take as long as you want, do it in stages. I mean, he never walked it in one go, for example. But he was this sort of eccentric character. I mean, it's difficult to sort of explain someone like him to non-British listeners, I think. But he's like, he said, like you touched on, that he wrote that he did his walks in his third best tweed suit. And he was like this pipe-smoking guy. And he was like, he was famously like misanthropic, antisocial towards other walkers. And people would come up to him and be like, oh, I love your books. And he just like completely blank them. Because he, as far as he was concerned, it was like, you know, he was out in the hills to enjoy the countryside. Like this other people were just an inconvenience. Yeah. So, you know, he did his own thing. I mean, I don't think he was a totally sort of unproblematic figure, but he certainly plowed his own furrow and, you know, did his own thing in life. And yeah, so what I was saying about Hadrian's Wall being one of the national trails and stuff, the coast to coast as it stands is not one of those. And so it's this legendary walk. It's the most popular walk, long distance walk in the UK. And so it has this kind of legendary status, but there's almost like part of the reason for that is because I think of this thing, it has a slight kind of like choose your own adventure element to it, because it's not signposted a lot of the time. A lot of the time you just be walking along and then suddenly you're in this like in the middle of a massive bog sort of thing. You got to like navigate it. There are sections which could potentially be a bit dangerous if you chose to do the dangerous route, particularly in the Lake District. But now, as of last year, they're in the process of turning the Coast to Coast into a national trail. So that's another reason why I did the walk now, because it was there aren't many of these national trails. And so it's an unusual opportunity as a travel writer to meet the people that are doing the work of turning it into a national trail and finding out how they do it, what work goes into that. And so that was why I decided to do it.
So this is very interesting. So you're kind of like checking your inbox one day and does someone reach out and say, hey man, we're doing this thing? Or are you kind of like, you have the idea in the back of your head and the timing just aligns to where you think, okay, this is the last time that people are going to be able to walk coast to coast without the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I should do it now before the rule book people come in and screw things up.
Well, it was again to sort of lift the lid a bit on how these articles come to be. So I had wanted to do it. It was on my endless spreadsheet of things I wanted to do, articles I wanted to write. And I wanted to do it this year because I knew it was the 50th anniversary. And actually, out of the blue, a tour operator got in touch with me. And they called Max Adventure. They asked me if I wanted to, basically, if they would sort out the accommodation and all that stuff. And then I would write the article and, you know, give them a nod.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Which,
too.
As you know, is how it works. Yeah, so
like 90% of the time.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it was perfect. It, you know, it's like it's one of these things. Obviously, to do it off your own bat under your own steam is 2 and a bit weeks staying in hotels in the UK. If that's the way you do it, obviously you can camp, you can wild camp. You know, it's not a cheap undertaking. So it was a massive privilege to get the chance to do it for work. Yeah. So yeah. It was one of those things where the stars just aligned, really.
So you get to St. Bees. Is that where you start in St. Bees? And you end in Robin Hood Bay, which I love.
Yeah, it's a good name.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. So I'm a sucker for everything like that. Mm-hmm. So get to St. Bees. And what's there? Is this just like a village in, on the coast? Or are there actual like things? Or is it outposts? Like what's there?
What's there? The answer is sort of not a great deal, really, which is true of like, in the best way possible, is true of a lot of the towns along the coast to coast, if you can call them that. I mean, the biggest place that you stop at along the coast to coast is a town called Richmond, which is in Yorkshire, the county of Yorkshire. And I mean, it feels, when you get there, it feels like a massive metropolis compared to what's been before. But I think it's only about maybe, I don't know, 40,000 people, if that.
Yeah.
Maybe like 20 even. So yeah, St. Bees itself is, it's like a, it's a sort of small village, on the coast, amazing coastal scenery. So the walk starts, on like a headland called St. Bees Head. And, there's not a great deal in St. Bees. There's a cool old church, where in the 90s, I think it was in the 90s, they were digging like, you know, in the churchyard, and they found a perfectly preserved, like mummified body.
Oh, that's,
as a guy, yeah, as he was a crusader, like a knight, who had died in some crusade somewhere, and then brought him back, and they'd mummified him in beeswax, preserved him in beeswax, and he's like perfectly preserved. And they've got like a display about him. He isn't there, but they've got a display about him. That's worth a look. And then, apart from that, there's like, you know, a couple of nice pubs. Most of these villages will have a couple of old pubs. And I mean, that's kind of it, really.
So you start at the place where the beeswax mummy was.
Yep. Yeah.
And you've got this is great. This is what I should have done at Hadrian's Wall. Because there's like, in my mind, there's a map that's just dotted with wilderness and then interspersed by pubs.
Yeah,
is not what I found at Hadrian's Wall.
No, it's a bit too remote, isn't it? I think Hadrian's Wall.
I was ill prepared, and Raven saved my ass because she is very over prepared for things and had food and all the things we needed. And I just thought I was going to stumble into a pub every day and eat. Didn't happen. But on the coast to coast, you can do that. It sounds like
you can.
So walk me through day one. We're not going to cover it like day by day by day because there's too many days. But walk me through day one and the feeling of actually setting out on this trail that you'd read about from Wainwright's handwritten books.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to feel like something was happening.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, like one of the big kind of like angles that I was like pitched when I pitched the article and that I wanted to sort of explore was like taking his book as my reference, you know, my reference guide, and seeing what has changed and what has stayed the same in those 50 years. And what's amazing is like how much just seems, it's so recognizable, you know, from what he writes. So, I mean, you know, it's not that much of a surprise, like villages like St. Bees, a lot of them haven't changed that much over the last 50 years, probably. But it's like, you can see like the cliffs all look the same. There's like chemical works off the coast, which obviously is a bit like incongruous with the sort of country walk vibe, but it's part of the landscape. It's there and it's still there. You can still see it. And he describes it. And even sometimes, like, he'll be he'll describe like a certain fence that's still there and stuff, and like, and he'll say like, he'll say, make sure you put your lay your jacket down over that barbed wire fence to avoid impaled testicles or what have you. I think is his language, which is hard to, difficult to argue with. And but then, you know, sometimes, because he was a very sort of like, he was a great writer, and he was very good at sort of putting you in the place. And sometimes, you know, he'll describe like a farm, which will still be there, and, you know, it'll still have the same name on the fence post, but he will describe like, you know, the two friendly Dobermans who came up and said hello. Obviously, they're not there anymore.
Shut up, the same Doberman. No.
And then some things where you walk past. So, I mean, I don't know if it's the same in parts of the US, but certainly in the UK now, alpaca farms are quite popular. Or at least not so much alpaca farms, but like some people will have some alpacas on their farms.
Yeah.
Which is always quite nice to see, because they're quite sort of friendly creatures. Obviously, 50 years ago, there wasn't so much in the way of alpacas. And it would have been interesting to see what Wainwright had made of it, because...
Are they just like hanging out where sheep like are? Are they just the sheep? Because one thing you should know if you haven't hiked or even been in the countryside in England is it's all sheep.
Yeah.
You cannot look anywhere without seeing a sheep.
Yeah, they're your constant companion. I mean, you see, it's not an exaggeration at all to say you see a hell of a lot more sheep than people when you're doing the coast to coast, or Hadrian's Wall, I imagine.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Like, I think as soon as you get out of the cities, there's like just sheep. I'm being dead ass serious. I don't think you could look anywhere in the English countryside and not see one. So,
yeah, it's true. I mean, and particularly that band of countryside Northern England, is a lot of it is just sheep. You know, sheep farming, and they just graze on the hills, and they have more or less free reign over, not free reign, but they reign over like massive periods, massive areas of farmland. So,
did they give you any tood when you walked by? Because like sometimes I found the sheep, the little blocky headed ones, they would look at you like they were going to step up. You know,
No, most of the ones I came across were just little cowards, just scatter as you approach. It's cows. You want to be a bit. I mean, I wouldn't say afraid of, a bit more wary of. I think if it doesn't happen like often, but every year some like people, walkers in England, sadly every year do get like trampled by cows. So again, it doesn't happen.
Difficult often, to achieve.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, if they've got calves with them, or if they've got their babies with them, you've got to give them a wide berth, but and keep away from bulls actually as well. I remember one time I was doing another walk in Yorkshire. It's from York to Whitby. So it finishes not far from Robin Hood's Bay, actually. But I had my trusty Osprey backpack on. It's like bright red.
Yeah.
And there are a few times walking through fields, because sometimes the footpaths just go right through fields with bulls in them. And they'll just have a little sign just saying, warning, bull in field, which is not that useful, really, when you've got to walk through it.
with a bright red
backpack on. So yeah, but you know,
they really don't like red. I thought that was just like,
I don't know. I think it might be a myth. I think maybe it's the sort of flash of a colored flag or something they don't like, but yeah, definitely not trying to rile them up when you're walking through, when it's just you and them.
I feel like you need more ropes. You need some lassos, cowboy hats. We fixed this. No one here getting run over by bulls. We got them under control.
Yeah. The rodeo has not come to the UK yet. Yeah. But it would make walking the coast to coast a bit more interesting. I went to a rodeo in Montana a couple of years ago, and that was a real highlight, actually, of anything I've done in the States. It was great.
Is it like the most American thing you can think of?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
So
me too. I don't just go to rodeos. I don't even think I've ever been to real. I've been to like some bull riding things in Texas.
Yeah,
yeah, that was cool. Yeah, but we don't just have them everywhere. I mean, you have to seek them out.
Yeah, we had to seek it out. We wanted to go to a demolition derby as well, but sadly, not ticked that one off yet.
Yeah, they're hard to find. So you're hiking, and I want to contrast this a little bit with Hadrian's Wall, because it's easy for me to describe where I was, a little bit north of the Coast to Coast Trail, on an official national walk. The path is like well-trod, it's dirt. It's not really, like, you're not going to lose it. You have to climb over some walls and things like that, but there's usually stairs. And along the way, you're guided by most of the way this ancient Roman ruin. So you're never going to lose your way. But on the coast to coast, you're just out there.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know where you're going?
Well, you are. There are stretches of it where it is signposted, but there are quite long stretches where it isn't. And you kind of just have to, I mean, you can read Wainwright's book and he kind of gives you vague directions. But you know, it's not like a proper sort of ordnance survey map.
Right.
And nowadays, I mean, there are loads and loads of sort of like modern guidebooks. I've got one here, where they do have proper maps. Some of them, I mean, you can get apps that have GPS on, and you can just basically follow it, and you'd do well to get lost. But, I mean, having said that, I got lost a couple of times on this, not majorly, but, like, I talk about it in the article. In the Lake District, I was walking up a hill called Kidsty Pike and got suddenly the cloud just sort of rolled in. And I was following, you'll know from doing Hadrian's Wall that they're like dry stone walls is what we call them, which is those gray walls where they're just held up. They're just stacked rocks. There's no, you know, no mortar or cement or anything in there.
Yeah. It's really an art form. They're all over the place.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And they stay up for, you know, like decades, centuries even. And they're sort of, they're a real feature of the English countryside, especially in the north.
Yeah.
To have these fields, rolling hills a lot of the time, and they're sort of demarcated by these dry stone walls and then just sheep, as you said, everywhere. I was following a dry stone wall, and then suddenly that sort of disappeared from view, and then I sort of was wandering off for a while. I think for about 10 minutes I was sort of stumbling around, and then I heard, funnily enough, actually a couple of Americans who I had sort of been walking near. They'd set off a bit earlier than me. They're ahead of me most of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of were calling out because they'd seen that I'd sort of vanished, which was good of them.
Really? So they were they mostly within sight of you? So they would have known this is kind of odd that like Dan's not on the trail.
I think that's what it was. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, I'm making it sound, I wasn't in, in severe danger, let's say, but, I'm pretty sure I would have eventually managed to find my way back, but, you know, just make for the top of the hill. But, yeah. And then, like I mentioned, the bogs earlier as well, you can get, there are parts of the coast to coast where even if you're, you know, following a trail or following like a map and a guidebook, where there are alternate routes because parts of it are so boggy that partly in order to protect the environment, but also to protect the path from just collapsing into a bog, you're supposed to go at different months of the year. I think there's three or four different routes. They're like color coded, so like January to March you might do the red route, March to June you might do green route, blue route, whatever. And so but even with that system in place, you can be walking along and suddenly like be, you know, knee deep in just boggy sort of marsh.
So I want to ask you to describe a bog to the American audience, because it sounds like
have a bog
place. Well, we have swamps, right?
Swamps,
and I think
yeah.
both sound equally ominous, right? Would you rather be lost in the bog or the swamp? Either one.
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, like a bog, I would say is less, it's less obvious that you're in it, you know, because it would look just sort of like green like grass really underfoot, and then suddenly you'd be like, oh, this is a bit spongy, and then suddenly you'll take another step and you'll just be like sucked in. Someone told me that the farmers sometimes in that area of the walk, that was in, I think it was the Yorkshire Dales, or maybe as you just get into the North Yorkshire Moors, the farmers there sometimes just lose cows into the bog. Like they'll just turn around
down.
And suddenly they'll see like a cow's head just sinking into the
they're just gone,
the bogginess. They're
and
just
they
gone.
Pop up like on the other side of the world and trample someone
like
in
a wormhole.
Asia.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. possibly. Yeah, that's a nice thought. Yeah. So I mean, I was kind of, again, I kind of enjoyed the element of having to sort of hopscotch onto. I sort of figured out how you can identify like slightly firmer bits of grass, and you can like hop onto one onto the next one, but. It was quite good weather when I did it. And if it's really tipping it down with rain, which is always a possibility in Northern England, especially,
Yes.
It could be a bit miserable, but it's all part of the adventure. And I think, yeah, like you, like I said, like it's becoming a national trail. For some people, sort of old school walkers and stuff, or old school coaster coasters, who some people have done it like dozens of times. And some of them feel like it's going to take away from it, the fact that it's going to be signposted.
But yeah, I want to ask you a little bit later on. I want to talk to you more about like some of the things going on in the outdoor world over there, because I've seen some issues, especially when it goes with right to roam and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I want to ask a little bit more about this coast to coast walk. So did you bring with you like a paper, pen and pad and attempt to write like Wainwright? I would be drawing sketches. And
No, I'm not much of a drawer, so I definitely didn't try that. But I think, what did I actually did take, so a friend of mine bought me for, I think it was a Christmas present or something a couple of years back. It's like it's a waterproof notepad, basically.
Yeah.
And you write on it with a special little pencil. And I had that with me. Luckily, like I said, I mean, the weather for the most part was pretty good. So if most of the time I was able to just, not very romantic, but just take notes on my phone, which is my kind of main, I know, modus operandi most of the time. I mean, I don't know how you do it. When I started out, the first thing I did when I got into travel writing was I used to write guidebooks. And I think I don't know, I was caught up in the, you know, the romance of being a traveling writer. And I was always filling notebooks up. I used to buy notebooks everywhere I went, go to like a market, buy a notebook. And write. I was obsessed with like blackening the pages of a physical thing. I think as time's gone on, I've just reverted to whatever the most practical, easiest thing is. But yeah, in terms of trying to write like Wainwright, I mean, as you know, it's always like it's a bit of a folly as a writer to try and imitate anyone, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't really work like that. And I agree with you with the paper notebooks. I do still bring them along, but I've taken to just using it as a journal for my own thoughts, not really anything for the story. And you can't practically take notes, like field notes with one, when you can just open your voice memos on your phone and talk. Sure, and then you throw that into like Otter and it'll transcribe all of your notes for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have it like kind of right there.
Yeah.
So this walk takes how long? It's 180 miles. So that would be what, like 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks. I mean, most people do it in about 16 days, something like that. So yeah, maybe I have a couple of rest days in the middle.
Is this normal for you? Do you do this kind of walk often? Or were you like, oh, that's kind of a long way, like I have to prepare myself?
Yeah, that's the longest one that I've done. I've done a fair bit of sort of longish distance. I've done a couple of like week-long hikes. Mm-hmm. That was the longest one. Preparing myself, I mean, what I would say is, I think sometimes with walking things in general is like, or hiking, like people think they can just rock up and just do it because they think it's just walking. I don't need to train for it. It's not like an endurance event. But I think it would actually be a mistake to just go straight into doing something like the Coast to Coast or Hadrian's Wall, having not done any long distance walking before, just because even if, you know, you're relatively fit and stuff, mainly because your feet aren't used to it, especially that's if you're carrying totally a heavy pack, if you're camping or something and you're carrying all your gear, you'll just get bad blisters. And that can be the difference between an enjoyable hike and, you know, just an absolute ordeal. So it's not that necessarily that you can't handle the weight, not necessarily that you can't handle the, you know, the stamina of doing it, but it's the feet, it's preparing your feet.
Yeah, I think that's wise. My experience with Hadrian's was exactly that. It was, even though I'd like broken some boots in and things, I was carrying a heavy pack, way heavier than I needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of days, that took a toll on my feet and my knees and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have like a walking stick, and people might laugh at if you know, have a walking stick. No, like you should probably have one. Even if you don't use it, they really come in handy, especially on a downhill. And I had like taken to just grabbing, I remember I grabbed this like wooden branch thing and I had it for days. I was really sad. I lost it somewhere. I was really sad because it was helping me. So I would say you should prepare. You may not have to like go to CrossFit for a year to go on a walk like this, but you do need to prepare yourself and go on some shorter excursions and figure out what weight pack works for you. How do you wear the pack? A lot of us don't know you actually need to like fit your backpack. It's just like a shirt or pants or something. You need a backpack that fits, that takes the weight off of your shoulders and puts it on your hips. That's important too. So there are like things that you need to know. And if you don't have a third best tweed suit, you should at least have like a second best.
For sure. And failing that, you know, just a base layer and like a sweat wicking base layer. Yeah. And then mid layer, something waterproof to put on the outside. It's pretty simple, but it's just, be a bit prepared. So and even stuff like knowing how to read a map and use a compass is a bit like people think I would need that nowadays. But like even in the UK, let alone someone like the US, you know, people still get lost, properly lost, you know, all the time. And they have to get mountain rescue out and all that. And half the time it's because they don't know how to read a map or they don't know how to read their surroundings.
That's true. There's a famous story about two American hikers in the UK. You probably know where this is going. And they come across an older British woman and like a slightly younger British man. And they're out on a walk in the north of England. And they start talking to them and chit-chatting them up. And they ask the British couple, like, will you take our picture? So it's not too long ago. So they hand the woman like a phone or a camera. She takes their picture and hands it back. And everyone goes along their way. And it turns out it was the Queen of England. She goes, wait till they figure out who took their picture.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't recognize it because I feel like Americans seem to be more interested in the royal family than Brits are, is how it seems to me.
It's possible, but we're all like pretty aloof, you know? And like the last time I was in London was right before the coronation. And my partner and I were just walking around Buckingham Palace, like wondering what the hell everyone was doing. So there's bleachers up and there's throngs of people, way more than usual. And we were just taking a shortcut through London and it was a terrible idea. So I didn't realize the coronation was going on like the next week or something. It was already a big scene. Talk to me about the kind of people you met along the path. I know the title of the story says, I didn't see another soul. clearly you saw a couple of people. Who was out there?
Well, I mean, as someone pointed out, it says, the headline says, I didn't see another soul. And then in the first paragraph, I talk about seeing people. So again, something else that you will know as a fellow travel writer is we don't write the headlines. If it's a misleading headline, don't blame it on us. But I met people along the way. The I didn't see another soul bit was a quote from a particular stretch of the walk in the Lake District where it's called Ennerdale Water. Beautiful lake, and Wainwright describes it in his book as being, I think he says, it's remote from the haunts of Lakeland's usual visitors, i.e. there aren't that many people there compared to the rest of the Lake District, which turned out to be true when I was there and I didn't see another soul along there. But the walk in general, I met, like I keep saying, but I met a lot of Americans, a lot of Australians, surprisingly, and a lot of these people had come all the way to the UK. Obviously they were kind of staying for a bit longer, but they had come to walk the coast to coast.
That's cool.
And that really surprised me actually, because, you know, I've heard of it as someone who's interested in the outdoors and lives in the UK, and lives in Northern England, but I had no idea it was famous, you know, across the pond or in Australia.
That's gotta be a cool feeling.
Yeah. It was great really to see the people who come to do it. And often it was, as is often the case in, certainly in the UK with these long distance walks or walking in general, it's quite often the preserve of like slightly older people, you know, people who are still fit and healthy, but like they have the time, you know, most people who are working like a proper job, not like what we do, they don't get the chance to just take 2.5 weeks off work and walk across the UK. So often it's kind of retired people or people who are on a sabbatical from work or something, or their kids have grown up and they've decided to have like a big adventure. And I think that, you know, anytime you get something like that, wherever it is in the world, it adds a good, really good energy to the thing. Because for loads of these people, it's like, it's a massive thing for them to be doing it.
It's a life goal. They've clearly had to put
thought into it. You have to pay your way, which we often don't have to do, and commit.
Yeah, it's a big investment to do something like that. And so, yeah, they were often not like old people, but, you know, like people in maybe middle age, late middle age, quite adventurous people, because you have to be to do that. So they were good fun. One of the nice things about it is that you'll go like I said, in each village, there's maybe like normally two or three B&Bs, maybe four in some of the bigger ones. Mm-hmm. So often you're staying in the same places as other people that you'll see the next night and the next night. And so it doesn't tend to happen for the whole thing, but you'll have maybe a few days where you'll get to your B&B or the pub or whatever in the afternoon, the evening, and you'll recognize these people. So you can sit and have a drink and talk about the day. Normally when you're actually out on the trail, it's kind of, the distances are big enough that you don't necessarily see
people. Yeah, everyone's at their own pace.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then at the end of the day, you often recognize people, and straight away it's easy to meet people because you can recognize that they're doing the coast to coast. You know, they look slightly disheveled and
smelly.
Their boots. Yeah, smelly. They got nothing on their feet because their boots are sort of drying by a fire or something like that. So there's a good camaraderie about it, let's say.
I like that. Did you have to book these B&Bs in advance, or do you just walk in?
You have to. Well, I mean, I would strongly advise people to book it in advance.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're camping, if you're wild camping, especially, it's like, I mean, we'll get onto that maybe, but wild camping, technically, you're not allowed to just rock up and do it. But realistically, like, you can do it, and loads people of people do it. Yeah. And it's about doing it in the right way, in a respectful way. But if you're camping in campsites as well, obviously, you're more likely to be able to just rock up. But I would say, certainly, if you're planning on staying in B&Bs, you need to book it, particularly if you're doing it like this time of year or spring or early summer. Yeah. It gets really busy.
I found this to be the case on the famous Camino Santiago in Portugal and Spain, which is the route I did earlier this year. Mm-hmm. It's famous for being one of those places where you just put on your backpack and you walk, you know, sometimes hundreds of miles from your destination, and you just rock up to a B&B, an alberg, and walk in. Mm-hmm. But I've found that the internet has changed that, and you really can't, because everyone is on their phone. You're using it as a wayfinder, even though the trail is well marked, mm-hmm. and using it to find restaurants and things along the way. And you also use it to book overnight accommodations. Now, mm-hmm. maybe you book them the night before and you don't know the whole route where you're going to go, because that's hard to plan. Mm-hmm. You don't know always how far you're going to feel like walking. But I did miss that, because I think that in the olden days, it must have been really cool in Wainwright's time to just say, I'll go in this vague direction, and then I'll find a pub, and then I'll just grab a room. And maybe, I guess you could phone ahead back then, but it does seem that the internet killed a little of that mystery. What do you think?
I agree. And I think it's partly the, on a route like the Camino or the coast to coast, you know, it's partly just the popularity of them now. I think, obviously when Wainwright did the coast to coast, it wasn't a thing. So like, I know that a lot of, even though, you know, those villages were there already, a lot of those B&Bs might have been there even, but I chatted to people who worked in who ran the B&Bs, who were like, you know, we wouldn't be here still if it wasn't for Wainwright. Like there's a whole kind of industry almost around the coast to coast.
It's amazing.
Now. Which is great, but you know, like you say, it can take away the spontaneity from it. I mean, that said, I want to say if you do it in like shoulder season, if you do it in autumn, in the fall, or you do it in the spring, like it could be doable to do it just to rock up and get a room. Certainly in the winter probably would be, but I think some of them actually would be closed in the winter because not a lot of people walk it in the winter.
Yeah, some people do. Just like Norwegians and Scots that would want to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they want a bit of a holiday. Go get warm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, by all means, give it a go. You know, part of the adventure would be, of course, you can't get a room. You got to sleep beneath the stars. But then, it's not always the best weather for that in England.
So, did you run across anyone who was camping out there?
I did. Yeah, I met a couple of people. Who were doing it. I mean, I'd say, you know, I was going to say doing it properly, carrying all their gear, wild camping, or you know, maybe camping in campsites if they come across one, just doing every day like as much as they wanted to do or felt like they could do.
Yeah.
And then just pitching a tent. And I mean, obviously that's like, it's a very romantic way of doing it.
Yeah.
It's physically more challenging. I think it's like, you really, you know, you've properly done it. You haven't taken any shortcuts if you do it that way. And the sense of achievement when you get to the end of such a long trail like that, if you're camping, must be awesome. Yeah, so I met a couple of people doing it. Having said that, I would say, particularly for like foreign visitors who haven't experienced like the British B&B thing and staying in these old pubs and stuff like that, it's way more comfortable. But it's also obviously like, you know, it's a little culture that's quite, it's very unique to the UK, I'd say, or to maybe like places like the UK and Ireland, but you wouldn't really get it in many parts of the world. And so it's part of it, I think, that.
Yeah. Tell us what that feels like. So, you know, you've got a good day on the trail, your boots are a little wet, your feet are tired. And instead of having to pitch a tent, which is what I would do by default, you're actually able to just go into a pub or B&B. What is it like? What's a typical scene?
Typical scene. Well, on the coast to coast, there'll be a mixture. There'll probably be a few coast to coast walkers there. Like I said, you can spot them a mile off. And then, you know, locals, I mean, these places are, apart from the coast to coast, for the most part, I mean, apart from the Lake District, which is touristy, the rest of the walk is not, it's not touristy areas at all. So it will be a few coast to coasters, and then it will just be the locals, you know, from the village, who tend to be, you know, pretty easy to get talking to, and you meet some interesting characters as well doing that.
Hard to understand too, usually. To me, I can't really understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, to me as well. but yeah, a lot of them, you know, it's like a classic scene of like a British pub. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing, particularly because Australians obviously have like pubs.
Yeah.
In the US, I think, It seems like a very British thing when people walk in and they'll see like this wood beamed old roaring fireplace.
Oh yeah, like that's a themed bar. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, real. Exactly. Yeah. So it's like that, but for real. And some of them are hundreds of years old, and it is very cool sometimes. And at the end of that, at the end of a long day, like you've done say 20 miles in a day or something, and then to get your boots off and just have a nice pint, you can't beat that. And like pub food. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that the food in pubs in the UK is the best food you'll ever eat in the world, but sometimes it's just all you need, you know?
It has filling. A place. It really does. On like a cold night with the rain coming down or a mist outside, and you just rock up and you grab some fish and chips or stew or bangers and mash and a pint. And I'm like, this feels right, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Wainwright is such a legend in Northern England that pretty much the whole way, and obviously along the coast to coast in general, but all the pubs, there's a beer called Wainwright
Gotta
Gold.
Gotta have that.
And it's good. I mean, if you like, again, it's very British. It's like, you know, like an ale, it's like room temperature, not fizzy.
I'm down. Yeah.
So you've got to have one or two of them at least when you're walking the coast to coast. So, it's an extremely British scene, I would say.
I love it. So when we did Hadrian's Wall, Raven and I started on the coast in outside of Newcastle, which is a huge city. And you really spend the first 2 days like just walking through it.
Yeah.
So you finally get out in the countryside for a few days. And it's pretty remote. We did bring tents. I'm American, she's Canadian, so our dumb asses thought, yeah, we just bring tents. I mean, we look like Frodo and Sam, like hiking across this ancient landscape.
Yeah.
And towards the end of the journey, I think we had like one morning left. I mean, we'd covered like the majority of the route. And we spent the evening walking along the wall in the ruins. And I flew a drone up, got some great shots that in my mind Nat Geo was going to buy and run with my story.
Yeah.
And they never do.
Yeah.
I don't know why you guys don't buy my stuff. I'm talking to you, Nat Geo.
Yeah.
I know where your office is. check your email. So so in my mind, I took all these shots, and Raven shot quite a bit too. Got all this footage, and we were just dead. Like, that was actually one of the hardest days on the trail. Maybe we'd done 20 miles on this place called the Sill, ironically.
Yeah.
And it's a big crag. It's badass.
Yeah.
It's like I really hope that I'm named after that and not a window, because it's really cool.
Of course, yeah. Your namesake.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. Very cool, yeah.
It's like a huge crag on the side of the island, and it drops down a couple hundred feet into these forests. It's really badass. There's a wall on top, just like Game of Thrones.
There's a great little hostel there as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We might have found that, because I remember being like super duper tired, and we were like, man, we don't want to put our tents up tonight. Like, my tent was wet, her tent was wet. We're like, okay, screw it. We're going to call a cab. So we sat on the side of Hadrian's Wall, got a cab to take us into the town. I think it was Brampton, and found one of these old British like B&Bs. And it was awesome. Like, I walked in, we smelled terrible. The poor people running the place. It was like a nice place, a nice carpet. It just seemed nice. We did not look nice. We went down to the bar, like the lower level. There's a big roaring fire, and it was cold out. And they had a legitimate, like, I don't know how else to say it. It might not have been a Michelin star restaurant, but it might as well have been. They had like a real chef cooking real homemade foods with real ingredients. It was like one of the best meals I'd ever had. It was like wild game and wild mushrooms, like all this stuff that you could just get in the north of England. It was really cool. And so to me, that with a pint, that is like the British B&B into the trail experience.
Oh yeah, for sure. And yeah, I mean, I was doing it down a little bit. But there is some amazing food to be had in those little pubs. Sometimes they're just in the middle of the countryside in the UK, and sometimes they are like within striking distance of trails like the Coast to Coast or Hadrian's Wall. So yeah, there's some good stuff out there for sure.
So you're on the trail for a couple of weeks, and you followed in Wainwright's footsteps, which must have just been such a cool feeling. And you've got your guidebook, you got his guidebook, and you finally see like Robin Hood's Bay. It's coming up on the map. What are your thoughts as you sort of find the end of the Coast to Coast?
It's a great feeling. It's a kind of, I mean, the last day is one of the longest days. It's 20 miles plus. And most of it's not too hard. It's like, I think from memory, it's kind of mostly on a quite, you go uphill a bit at the beginning, and then you're sort of on a gentle descent for most of the rest of the way. But as you get towards, so actually on that day was when I met one of the people from the National Trail Association, actually from Natural England, but they oversee the National Trails. Mm. And he walked with me for like an hour or two, and he was showing me what they're going to do. For example, how they're going to put some of the paths across the bogs, which is they're going to lay like flagstones. And actually it was awesome to hear about how they do that, because you'd think like, you just laying some stones in the countryside, but
yeah,
you can't get vehicles up to these places. So the way they have to do it is they have to fly a helicopter, which can only carry like, I don't know, three flagstones or something, because they weigh like tons, each of them.
Yeah.
They have to hover it down. They have to like winch it down.
Whoa.
Hover, go back, get more flagstones, do it again. So it's a massive undertaking. Oh, the same God. With like some of the woodlands as well. You can't, you know, there's no way of getting, you can get in there on foot, but you can't get in there with like loads of materials.
Are they flagstoning the whole path?
No, only on very, very boggy bits. Oh, so yeah. Their interventions are like minimal. And it's partly because they don't want to ruin the, you know, the feeling of like the last thing you want is just a paved road across the country. It's like, there's no fun there. So, but also because they want to minimize disruption to the natural environment, because a lot of these places are national parks. Mm-hmm. There's animals living there, ground nesting birds and things like that, and rare plants and stuff. So they want to minimize their disruption to that. So yeah, it was cool to hear about that. But then, so we got over a particularly boggy section, which wasn't hasn't yet been flagstoned. So that was a bit of an ordeal. And then we got to the end. This guy, his name is Bruce, he's said his goodbyes. And I was walking. I just had to finish it then. And I got to a junction in the road. There's slight, like, a couple of bits where it the path meets, like, a, you know, like a car, a main road sort of thing. And I had to cross over it. And I noticed there was a sign, Robin Hood's Bay, and it said, like, 3 miles or something. And it was just straight, arrow straight down down the hill to the village. And I was so tempted at that point to just follow that road. I would have been there in, you know, 45 minutes or something. And but I resolved I had to go the way that Wainwright did, which is just like at the beginning of the walk, where he takes you up St. Bee's Head, which is this massive headland, and you go up a massive hill, and it's a really circuitous route. You don't even start walking east, which is like, you know, it's west to east, west coast to east coast. You actually start walking east for like 2 hours because you have to go up this hill, go west for a bit, and then walk east. So it's the same on the other end at Robin Hood's Bay. There's this massive headland, and he wants you to go up, down, undulating path that goes like round and round about, and it's just exhausting by the time. But coastal views are amazing. And eventually Robin Hood's Bay, so you're up on a cliff, and Robin Hood's Bay, you're overlooking the bay basically, and you see the little village on the east, or to your right even. And yeah, then it's kind of, once you can see it, you know, you get that adrenaline rush that sees you through to the end.
Did you make time to sit and think?
Oh yeah, and to stand and stare, like he, just like he recommended, for sure. I mean, I think, like, I agree with him on that. You know, you have to, there's no point just getting out there and trying to rush it, you know? We did last year, me and a couple of friends, I wrote an article about this as well, actually, but we went up to Scotland, to the Highlands, to do a walk. There's a walk to, they call it Britain's most remote pub, or the most remote pub in mainland Britain.
It's
a place called the old Forge. And the only way you can get there is you can take a boat, which takes half an hour, or you can walk for 2 days across the Highlands. And so we did it.
Yeah,
and that was another one where you take the two days and you sleep in a little, what they call a bothy in Scotland, which is just like a little stone shelter. And I mean, you know, realistically, we could have done it in a day. It wasn't that, the distance wasn't that great, but we wanted to break it up because partly you get the experience of sleeping in the bothy, get more time in the pub at the end.
Yeah, that's cool. So is it like I guess it'd be like a lean-to or something in the States, or we have some of these stone huts in the Rocky Mountains that are people will bike pack to.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
a bothy is like a stone hut.
Yeah, and they vary a lot. I mean, this one had a few like wooden bunks in it.
Yeah,
a lot of them literally just have. Some of them might have a fireplace. Some of them have, like, you know, a gas stove or whatever. They vary a lot.
This sounds like a witch's house.
Yeah, they have a witchy vibe. Funnily enough, actually, in that one, there was a little guest book, and we were reading what people had written. And there was a few people had written stuff like, I'm a scientifically minded person, but I experience things in this bothy that I cannot explain.
Oh, great.
Stuff like that. Great. Yeah, that'll get me off to sleep nicely. But yeah, they're old, like, shepherd's huts and stuff. They're actually, I should mention that on the coast to coast, there's a really cool one. And this probably is one where you can, certainly not, if you're not in peak season, you can probably rock up and sleep there. It's a youth hostel. And they call it, Wainwright describes it in his book as Britain's loneliest and most romantic youth hostel, I think, or the loneliest and most romantic of youth hostels. It's called the Black Sail. And it's literally just, it's in the middle of, just after Ennerdale that I mentioned, in Ennerdale Valley, this just tiny, like, centuries old shepherd's hut. And it's been a youth hostel for 100 years, something like that.
That's cool. And
it's very cool. Yeah.
I feel that's the kind of place I would want a t-shirt, but they probably wouldn't sell them.
Yeah, I don't think they do. I'm not sure they do a t-shirt. They do. They do have a little honesty cafe where you can buy, like, you know, chocolate and stuff. So that's probably, that probably wasn't there 100 years ago. But yeah, so something else, something that I forgot to mention, when you're at the beginning of the walk, tradition has it, as Wainwright did, you're supposed to dip your boots in the Irish Sea, which is the sea on the west coast, and you pick up a stone, like a pebble, from the sea, and you carry it with you all the way to Robin Hood's Bay. And then when you get there, you chuck it in the North Sea, which is that sea, and then you dip your boots in there. So yeah, so that's what I did. So I got, when I got to Robin Hood's Bay, got down to, I mean, it was another one of them where it's like, I walked past my hotel that I was staying in. It's like a, and I still had another like 45 minutes or something to go. And I was like, do I really have to get down to the sea?
Yeah, you do.
Get my boots, but you have to do it. If you made it that far, you've got to do it. Yeah, so it was an awesome feeling to get there.
It feels right. I remember I had a little necklace that I carried at Hadrian's Wall, and I did the same thing. I didn't know about that story, but I did. Mm. I feel like I made sure at the end I dipped it in the Irish Sea because I was going the other way.
Exactly, yeah.
And I was looking across at Scotland, and I was like a couple hundred yards from the finish line where there was a pub, which was great. Mm.
Yeah, that was helps.
Yeah, and a buddy with a vehicle to take me back to like civilization.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So that was really, really special. Yeah. Dan, I want to ask you a couple more questions as we kind of wind down here. Mm-hmm. First of all, love the story about Scotland. That's neat. I'd love to do an episode about something up in there sometime. Mm-hmm. Sure. But you just put out another story on BBC. It's called England's Mysterious Sunken Roads. This is cool to me because sunken roads are something we don't have a lot of in most of the United States, mm-hmm. but I found them a lot in Portugal on the Camino, where you're just walking through this forest that feels ancient and you're 10 feet down, you know, you're, what would that be like? 2 or 3 meters down into the forest is this road. So where are these sunken roads in England and how can people go experience those?
So there, I mean, I'd kind of always been aware of them, but kind of maybe unknowingly. So there, I grew up in the southwest of England, in Wiltshire, which is probably most famous for being where Stonehenge is. It's the county that Stonehenge is in.
Oh, yeah.
So there's pretty ancient landscape. Mm-hmm. One of the features of it, and there's loads of them, are these sunken roads, sunken lanes. But a lot of them are like roads that you drive along. And I think, especially when you're a kid and you just think, oh, well, it's just a road with a bank on each side, with trees on the top. You don't really think about why it's there.
No,
you just think, just a path, you know, in the countryside, or whatever. There's now a road. But it turns out that there, so in Wiltshire, and then they're particularly concentrated in a place called Dorset, which is the county, like, it's a near close to Wiltshire, also in the West Country. Mm-hmm. And there's like, yeah, loads and loads, you know, like hundreds of miles of them. And the definition of which, so we call them holloways in the UK. And again, holloway, you know, it's a name, I think, in the US as well. It's probably a fairly common surname.
No, loads of holloways everywhere. Yeah.
And so again, because it's a common word, I mean, there's a place in London called Holloway. Mm-hmm. There are places all over called Holloway. And you never really think about why that is.
No.
But the reason is because it's been named after one of these holloways, which just means a hollow way, i.e. a road that's been kind of carved out in the countryside.
They look like a tunnel almost in the forest. The canopy is like the trees.
Especially in the summertime where the trees on the side of the banks like, you know, meet in the middle because they're so full of greenery. So it's like you're in this little kind of sort of underworld, which is quite a cool sensation. But yeah, the definition of a holloway is something that has been, they're not natural features in the landscape, which if you think about it, they kind of wouldn't be really, because they're different from like a river valley, you know, or something like that.
Well, they're straight line rather than meandering.
Yeah. And they're very kind of, you know, if they were caused by erosion, they wouldn't be so sort of narrow. Some of them are so narrow, maybe just, you know, a couple of meters across sort of thing, but really, like you say, 10 feet deep, something like that. But they're caused by human activity, essentially. So normally over hundreds, sometimes even thousands of years, by people walking along them and by people driving animals along them, and maybe like ox carts and stuff going along them. And so it's one of these things that, like, when you don't know about it, it's just like a place that you might go for a walk or walk the dog or something.
Yeah.
But when you know why it's there, it suddenly kind of brings the landscape to life a little bit. And you're like, by the fact that you're walking in them, you know, you're contributing to their existence. And one of the really cool things about them is that, so most of the time, you know, we associate human activity with destroying the landscape, destroying natural habitats, which is normally is true. But with holloways, because they're such a unique environment where things will be sheltered, and the temperature's constant, only gets a certain amount of sunlight, they have become sort of refuges for really rare plants in particular, but also like types of bees and fungi and stuff like that.
That's interesting.
Again, yeah, other places,
because the wild areas like on the sides of them stuff, you can't really groom that, so it's just wild.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're actually in their own way by, and when they overgrow. So I met for the article, I met a couple of people who are like ecologists and an archaeologist who are working on a project to map the Holloways. But they were saying, yeah, it's this rare kind of, you know, they encourage, normally with something like that, the scientists would want to close stuff off to the public, stop them from damaging it.
Yeah.
I mean, you walk down these Holloways now, a lot of them, there's a famous one that we went to called Shoot Lane, which is in Dorset. And there's graffiti on the walls. Like some of it looks really ancient, but then you realize it can't be ancient because this is like sandstone walls. So it gets eroded really quickly.
Mm.
But you walk in, a lot of it's really modern, obviously really modern. So like you see like Homer Simpson will be on there, or like Squidward will be on there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cartoon characters and stuff. So I said to these people, you know, like, does that annoy you as someone who's trying to preserve and protect these environments? And they said no, because they need, you know, these wouldn't exist without human activity, without people walking along them. And they need people to carry on doing that. And those Holloways, there are loads of Holloways that have just been abandoned and forgotten about, overgrown. And they don't support these, you know, rare species in the same way that
they need the foot traffic to keep it like open enough.
Yeah, exactly.
That's,
I think that's quite a nice thing, because you're participating in this sort of ancient process when you walk along a Holloway and you erode it a little bit with your footsteps. But you're also like, even if you scratch your name on the wall, like people have probably been doing for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, you're contributing to that.
So the last question I have for you is about the right to roam that you talked about earlier in the story, because you're from a country that's so rich in literature, especially when it comes to traveling.
Yeah.
You've got obviously like the King Arthur, you've got Lord of the Rings, you've got Wainwright, like all of these stories revolve around long journeys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask if the right to roam is under threat. Are there any places where they're trying to take that away? Because it seems to me like that would remove some of the inspiration for new stories.
Yeah, for sure. And it is, I think, under threat. How much is under threat kind of varies depending on who you talk to. I mean, it's been in the news lately because there's a protected area in southern England called Dartmoor.
Yeah.
Which, as the name suggests, mostly sort of moorland area, but it's one of the places, the only place in fact in England, it's allowed in Scotland, but most of England you're not allowed to wild camp, like I said earlier.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have, like, technically, you know, you have to get the permission of a landowner and all this. Like I said, realistically, if you do it responsibly, it's not normally an issue. But Dartmoor, it was legal to just rock up and wild camp. And so that was quite a special thing that it was the only place in England you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the landowner successfully went to the courts and had that right removed, effectively. This is, like, within the last... Well, it all came to a head within the last sort of year or so.
Really recent history.
Yeah. Happily, however, it was appealed and it's been overturned. So that in itself, for now at least, seems to be like, okay. But it's kind of more of like the wider question of, you know, do private landowners allow people to access their land, which, like I said, in the UK is considered to be almost like a human right to be able to walk across the countryside. Not everywhere, obviously, but on footpaths. But, you know, at the moment, government is a conservative government and they're pretty hot on private property and all those sorts of things. And they are trying to make it a criminal offence to trespass on land. So at the moment, you're not going to get a criminal record for trespassing on someone's land. I'm not recommending that people do it, by the way, but they're trying to change that, and it's all sort of, you know, whether it goes in that direction depends. They probably won't be in power for much longer, but obviously nobody really knows what's going to happen with that.
Difficult situation though. So but people will be able to walk regardless of what happens in Dartmoor. They can walk coast to coast. They can walk any of the UK's national trails, which are, in my experience, are surreal and amazing. So I, for one, can't wait to get back over there and start hiking. Where is your next trip? What's the next assignment?
Assignment, good question. I'm actually going to Croatia. So awesome. Our mutual paymasters at Geo sending me to Istria in early September. I mean, my next foreign assignment is I'm going to stay with my girlfriend's parents in Italy for a week, just for a holiday, which
that
will be
sounds really nice.
There will be some work going on, probably emails and what have you. But my next work trip is going to be Istria, Croatia. I think we're going to focus on the coast. Looking forward to that.
I can't wait to read about it. You guys can look up a couple of the links to Dan's stories in the show notes. I'll link to I Didn't See Another Soul, which is the premise of the show. And I'll link to England's Mysterious Sunken Roads as well. Dan, thanks for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it. It's great talking to you. I hope I see you out there in the travel writing world eventually.
Yeah, man. It's been a pleasure. As you know, as travel writers, any opportunity to just talk about ourselves for an hour or two, we're gonna grab it with two hands. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks, man.
The Get Lost Podcast is a production of Sold Outside Exploration Company. Make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast app and share the show with your friends.